I would like to thank the Washington Post, our presenting sponsor, for its support. I would also like to thank our panelists, Deborah Anzinger, Heidi Fancher, Shasha Feng, Tammy Gold, for contributing their time and thoughts to this discussion. It's a pleasure to introduce our moderator, Jose Ruiz. Jose is an artist who exhibits internationally. He is also the founder of Furthermore, a research, production, and development lab in Washington, D.C. He is a co-founder of Present Company, an exhibition, performance, and social space in Brooklyn. Please join me in welcoming our panel.
Thank you. First, I want to thank everyone for coming. The panel is an hour. We have a lot of information that we want to share with you guys, so we'll try to hit as much as we can. Social practice is a pretty broad and evolving field that's changed dramatically over the past 3-4 years, I would say. And also want to thank the people of the fair for inviting us and actually bringing this topic for one of the panels, which I think is important. First, I actually wanted to introduce a little bit of bio on everybody here. Deborah Anzinger, to my left, is a visual artist and executive director of New Local Space, NLS, a Kingston-based contemporary art initiative through which she has organized and curated exhibitions locally and internationally, written for regional publications, sat on panels, including the SF MoMA's Open Space, and led an outreach program for Kingston-based artists that has hosted local studio visits from the Paris Art Museum in Miami, PAM, and the Tyson Barneza Art Contemporary since 2012. Deborah is also an artist, and her work plays with abstraction and the shifting narratives of power through surrealism. Her work has been exhibited in Jamaica, at the National Gallery of Jamaica, in the Caribbean, and at the Trinidad and Tobago Film Festival, and Liquid Courage Gallery. In D.C., she's exhibited at Transformer, the Arlington Arts Center, George Mason University, Civilian Art Projects, Hilliard Art Space, and the Corcoran Gallery of Art. Deborah received her Ph.D. in immunology and microbiology in 2005 from Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. Heidi Fancher, all the way to the left, received her MFA from MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art. Her work as an artist has explored issues of racial and cultural identity by using historical records, photographs, films, and first-person narratives as a point of departure. Through her work, she aims to interpret the challenges and the history of what it means to be African-American, African-Caribbean, and Haitian in a contemporary Western society. She began exploring race and an early body of photographic work that I'm sure you'll bring up, that explored the African diaspora identity and the complex history of race in relationship to stereotypes. To my right, we have Tammy Gold and Shasha Feng, who work collaboratively, and they have a project downstairs as well. They're both based in New York. And they have rich bios as well. Tammy Gold is a professor at Hunter College, a filmmaker and a visual artist. Her films have consistently been at the forefront of social justice, focusing on issues of race, gender, sexual identity, labor, and police brutality. They have reached audiences near and far, airing on PBS, HBO, and on television in Nigeria, South Africa, Germany, France, Turkey, Serbia, Lagos, and Vietnam. Her work has also been screened at the Whitney Museum and the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Chicago Arts Institute, the Kennedy Center, the American and British Film Institutes, Sundance, Tribeca, and the New York Film Festival, and in over 150 LGBT film festivals worldwide. She is a recipient of both a Rockefeller and a Guggenheim fellowships, and her print work and scribbles have been presented at galleries in Brooklyn, New York, Brazil, and Mexico. Shasha Feng combines the best of both arts and technology to develop socially conscious media. She's a multimedia programmer and designer. Her work includes a range of experiments which integrate web-based and open-source technologies. She has presented work at various galleries and events, including at The Kitchen in New York, iBeam 3LD, Conflux, George Washington Carver Gallery, and Staten Island Museum. Shasha produces iArt, which is an interactive art show with her students in the Film and Media and Integrated Media Arts MFA program at Hunter College, where she also teaches. She is a co-founder of Divas for Social Justice, DIVAS, meaning Digital Interactive Visual Arts Sciences, a grassroots community organization that aims to bridge the digital divide and teach media literacy and culture awareness amongst young women of color. So as you see, the panel here comes from a very broad and diverse background, so I think the conversation will be really interesting. I first wanted to go into kind of how do we define social practice today, because I think many people have different interpretations of that meaning, and that term is used sometimes loosely. And as I said before, the medium or the discipline has changed a lot over the past 4 or 5 years. I would personally define it sort of as perhaps a fourth position between community art, education, and activism, but people have varying opinions on that. So that's kind of the first question I wanted to throw out to you guys. I'm not sure if maybe Deborah, you want to, how do you define social practice? And maybe also in relation to the project, you know.
Well, I would define social practice first and foremost as any practice that's going to bring people together, and it can be to a number of ends. For our organization, the end goal of bringing people together, artists together, was to be able to project multiple voices and bring in different narratives into what was considered Jamaican art. We had dominant narratives. A lot of it was African retention. They were all relevant narratives, but they were really very one-dimensional. And we felt it was constricting for artists, contemporary artists, to work within that kind of framework. So we wanted to really create a larger space. So we wanted to bring people together so that a larger and a different kind of space, a richer space, could be created. And we really wanted to bring the public into that conversation as well by keeping it as transparent as possible. So for us, that is how we really approach social practice, and that's really the definition of it. It's just bringing people together towards that mean. Yeah.
Okay. Heidi, do you want us to speak a little bit? How social practice kind of has seeped into your practice?
Social practice in my work is mainly about biography and about exploring the lives of individuals that not necessarily will be able to have their stories told, but live these very fascinating, very interesting lives. And you want to draw on those and highlight those experiences. So I definitely try to reinforce the individual, the power of the individual voice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And can you, Tammy and Shasha, kind of tell us the collaborative project, Surveillance, and then how social practice is at the core of that project?
For everything I do really is grounded in social practice. For many years, I've been a documentary filmmaker, and one who's really, my objective is always to reach a community. Sometimes we call it narrow casting because it's a very specific community. It doesn't have to be broadcasting. And then others are really provocative that are intended for television or for watching collectively. I mean, there's a real discourse around watching something on television alone and watching it with a group, because the group viewing is a very different experience than when you watch in isolation. So out of that, I've always been doing art, and my personal art practice is very often not about social practice. It's really about personal expression, but it always tends to be naked women. So maybe there's something grounded in that that has to do with both social practice and personal. But what happened in terms of the project, I'll speak really briefly, is post 9/11, right after 9/11, living in New York, I was down at the site of where the World Trade Center was, and all around Lower Manhattan, people were selling cards. They were selling cards that showed they vilified the Iraqis. And it was kind of interesting at that point because the country was not even looking at Iraqis or that there was going to be an intervention. And I purchased them, and here's some examples. These cards were sold, and these were about the great American heroes, our military, and our leadership, George Bush. And then I had the other cards. And then suddenly I found myself finding in restaurants, hot sauce, that the hot sauce said, burn bin Laden, burn. And then toilet paper that said, wipe out bin Laden or wipe out terrorism. And gradually I made this collection, always intending to do a public art project with it to engage an audience. So then Sasha and I decided to collaborate in this effort.
And a lot of my work is web-based, open-source, interactive work where you can access it on the web or have it in public space and installation art because, you know, when you want to tell a social message, you don't want to lecture to people. It's a nice way to experience it in all five senses. So if you walk into a space that's public, it's, you know, unexpected, and you give them the space to walk through, you'll get the sounds. How does that person feel at that time? And then by you being the person, your body is part of the experience that would trigger certain things happening. If you walk closer here, you might hear a different voice. For our project, we designed our own cards as a response. And using technology, you could scan this code and get a little bit about who is this? Who are these clues that you're reading about? And we have downstairs audio, so it's randomly playing. So you could interact with this in a nonlinear way. It's not where in a film, which is a different medium, you sit there together and experience everything in that 1 hour or 2 hours, and you come out and you discuss about it. But this is when you walk into space, you interact with other people, and then you can have a discussion about it. And it's to provoke thought.
Great. I think, too, a couple of things you guys said that was really interesting, this idea of, like, narrow casting, right? And just having where the community gets focused in. And in some ways, the art world is like that, too. But he also said something kind of in Jamaica, the social public changing the perception of what art is or contemporary art is. So the question, in many ways, there's this community in quotes, which is sort of the invisible elephant to a lot of social practice projects, and also relational aesthetics. So how do we, each of you, how do you deal with that term community? Because I think when you say the word community, people have very different interpretations of it. We may think of a kid's mural, you know, in an inner city in Philadelphia. We may think of a retirement home. But I think that's, in many ways, it's the crux of certain projects. But it also, it can be liberating if it is a focused community, right? So I don't know who wanted to take that question.
I mean, I can try. I think that depending on what kind of vernacular you're using, community can mean a few different things. But I do think that at a very basic level, one of the distinctions is going to be, are you targeting one particular group of people, or are you trying to build a community? Are you using that practice to uplift a particular community, or are you trying to build a community around something? And I think that you can do both. I don't think that they're necessarily mutually exclusive. I think that we do both. We're trying to build a community around contemporary art that wasn't there before. And then we're also trying to empower the art community, the contemporary art community, and make them function more like a community rather than just in their individual practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for Heidi, how does the community play a role in your studio projects?
In my studio projects, I always try to look for group dynamic stories, narratives, biographies that tell history of a place, of individuals that are struggling with racism or sexism, or the African diaspora, which is a very big part of my work. Social portraiture is where I normally, my strength is, in introducing individuals, as I said before previously, that normally their stories would not be able to be told because of economic issues or some type of other issue. Mm-hmm. I try to really focus on getting their story out, getting their voice out, making their struggle or whatever in their community is going on.
Right.
Visible and very verbal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think what Deborah said, one thing she said that was interesting is that the difference between building a community and targeting a community, right? How do you guys feel about that?
For example, a project that I worked with for Divas Together was doing both. Mm-hmm. We had the community in Bed-Stuy, in Brooklyn. We wanted to highlight all the green spaces that were available. Even being in the community in there, we didn't realize there were so many little green gardens, and even people living there were not aware until we started. So we also built community, invited the community, and the young women in the community together to empower them with the skill set of video documentation, and collaboratively built an interactive map. After the whole event, we created this large map that was built with everybody, and invited everybody from the neighborhood in to come and see where are the green spaces, and then give them also additional paper maps that they could take with them to their schools. And for people doing biking, they can figure out, and the surprise was, wow, I didn't know in the next block there was a green garden there, or I live in this block, and somebody else would come in and say, hey, I live there too. And then we documented some gardens that eventually were taken away by developers, or so it acted as a way to preserve history and layers of time that we wouldn't be able to when you walk past that space again.
My practice has been very different. Coming out of a linear art form, which is documentary filmmaking. In fact, the exhibit here does have a very strong documentary component, but it's more experiential, and I'm having anxiety attacks because I don't know if people are getting it. I'm freaking out, who's my audience, and am I broadcasting, narrowcasting? So there's a lot of growth right now in terms of different forms of creation. I have always built community. That's definitely what drives me. And it's not just building community for the sake of community. It's really for social activism and for social change and justice. So some years ago, I made a film called Every Mother's Son, which was personal stories, very much like you're talking about. And it's women who might not have told their own stories. And there are three mothers in New York whose sons were killed by the NYPD. So we have three mothers and their journey to activism, and that becomes a catalyst to build a community. And so the film was on PBS and has been all over the country and many places in the world. That was 10 years ago. Sadly, I wish it was collecting dust, but it's not, because there's a crisis in the United States in terms of police brutality. So the film has had a new life right now where it's really everywhere. And to me, it ebbs and flows, because at one point it was able to really galvanize, and that was in 2004. And now, 10 years later, it's working in the same context. It's galvanizing communities. So my work has journeyed now into something that might be less linear, but still is grounded with the notion that we have to ask questions, we have to explore, and we can't accept the status quo.
Great. One thing I've been thinking about too is, particularly for the audience, you know, and the people that support art as well, you know, how can we support the role of the artist in regards to social change? You know, because all the projects here are grassroots projects, whether it's a nonprofit, you know, or just a collaboration. And obviously collaboration is a hidden word in all these projects, I think. But how can we further support the role of this type of practice? Because it happens outside of institutions. It is not primarily made or can be contained in a gallery. And then there's this issue of like space, public. And a lot of times it needs public space. Yeah. It needs technology. It needs a lot of research too. So I wanted to hear kind of your thoughts. Like, what are some things? Could there be further support from maybe private agencies or grants? I know, you know, as a nonprofit you get grants, but even grants can be limiting in that they give money for more so for programs, but not for the people. And in my experience with nonprofits, a lot of times we're chasing grants and we become more busy with these programs that we have to do, but then we're just doing more than we can mm-hmm. just to keep the organization going, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know who wanted to maybe.
I think you should take it. I mean, I'm working in a completely different space. There is no public funding for art, for contemporary art in Jamaica. I would love to hear what Hagi says.
I believe that we should have more funding. We definitely need more money in terms of money access to resources to create these spaces that will allow artists to explore and to produce work that really will help not just communities, but I mean globally it will impact people. So I think we need more money.
From the non-profit perspective, I know that we get money for programming, and even then that's not a lot due to the economy. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to have more overhead funding to keep an organization running. For an EDU, we're both lucky enough to be teaching, and that gives us the place to test things out, to build things. And we're lucky enough that both of us have different skills that we don't have to hire somebody else to do the design, to program, to do all of this. But even buying equipment is an issue, we work for a public university, and that's totally different than private funding and getting grants as well.
Money. Probably being the oldest person here, I had a great experience back in the day before Reagan. I'm one of the few CEDAR artists. CEDAR was a program, and it was a program to train people in non-traditional work or work to have people get out of poverty or out of public assistance, etc. And it was somewhat modeled after the Roosevelt program, and I just forgot the name, and I just watched the documentary. But we all know the programs that had artists working. So I was paid, yes, WPA. And I worked as an artist for a year and a half, and I was paid. And then we had Reagan, and all these programs were cut. So there's no question, in the United States, there's money, there's not the will. And public art, and art that engages community, I mean, it's like, it's critical. Art is really, it's like what we breathe. It's like it makes life have meaning, whether it's poetry or narratives or narrative stories. And I think that it's really about how do we re-engage a country to understand that this is really valuable for a people.
Great. I mean, I think with that thought too, I mean, there's, even in nonprofits, there's like the buzzword is like partnerships, right? Which is kind of a fancy way of saying collaboration, right? But there is a lot of interest to kind of have artists and arts organizations work with outside of the art world, But there's, I think, very little counter where business is actually helping arts organizations, right? I mean, I think there's some very interesting projects in the Midwest where they're hiring artists to essentially be problem solvers in cities that are changing, whether it's development, gentrification, and then there's a very interesting happening in the Midwest, but it hasn't reached the coast where the money is, right? The East Coast or the West Coast, and I think that's kind of a problem, but I think that's a model that we should be looking at, ideally, like the WPA, like having artists be employed just to think, just to research, I think a lot of the skills that we learn in art school can be used as very critical skills in life, and we do see corporations starting to hire artists, right, as thinkers, not for their art, graphic design skills, but to just solve problems, right? Even Apple prefers at times to hire people with a liberal arts education than a programmer, right? Because they look at the world differently. But I think a question that I wanted to add was, if our projects, if these projects, in theory, they're outside of the art world, right? They're community, real life social issues. And if we go out into this world and create partnerships, what's the cause to come back to art, right? We make art, and that's sort of the vessel for the way we communicate. But once we've gone out in the real world and achieved change or tried to implement change, what brings us back? Deborah?
I don't. I guess I don't see it as bringing back. I think of it just as a continuum. I think that partnerships is a key word. I'm glad you brought that up, because working in a space where resources is always the buzzword, the lack of resources, and just there is the politics of scarcity at play with almost everything that you're doing, and that works against partnership, because, you know, if the definition of partnership is something where you have shared risks and shared responsibilities, different responsibilities, but shared, and then the risks of the project being shared as well. When you're dealing with the politics of scarcity and lack of resources, these are things that counterintuitively prevent people from partnering with each other. But once you can work, once you can actually shift those paradigms, it becomes a very fruitful thing, because yes, if you're dealing with less resources, you share our room, our suite here at Emerge is an example of that. You know, you share the cost, whether it is administrative structure and administrative responsibilities, and then at the end of the day, the risk is also shared, and that's how we can actually get into other conversations and really make the conversation a lot larger because of the partnership. And the same thing, you know, we had a project with Transformer earlier in the year in May, and that was also a partnership. So I think that's a way to engage these larger conversations and even get more funding, is by art stepping out of itself a bit and doing this very same kinds of things that you're saying they're doing in the Midwest. But I also do think it's our responsibility to engage, to initiate those conversations a lot of the times, you know.
I have a question. What about Philip Morris? The tobacco company's putting a lot of money into art, and they're funding artists. How do we respond to that, and what's the social practice around that? There's a lot of Philip Morris's out there, and that's something that I believe musicians and painters and filmmakers, we have to grapple with. Can we take that money? So my question is, what do you all think?
Heidi?
That's definitely I struggle with that. You want to do a project and have it be the best project, not just for you as an artist, but also for the people that you are depicting or serving. And I don't know. I mean, for me, that's something that I grapple with every day. You know, should I take that fund, knowing that it came out of something that was not healthy, you know, cigarettes, you know, do I take that money? That's definitely a hard question to answer, I think. Personally, for me, would I do it? I don't think so. But there's other people that might take that and turn it into something that would be a positive experience or positive project. Mm-hmm. Don't know. It's catch 22.
Personally, I would look at, even in general, no matter whether it's Philip Morris or any organization, when you're applying for a grant, there are stipulations. So you have an agreement when you do get the grant or when you apply. What I would do is read very carefully and see what the implications are. What do you have to fulfill? If you don't agree with that, then you can walk away.
Mm-hmm. And Deborah, what do you think? I mean, sort of the ethics behind, I mean, where maybe we're kind of what you're saying, though, you know, the support does come from somewhere, and not all money is clean. And our project perhaps can change that, but is that something that you wrestle with?
You know, we don't have foundations that are set up specifically for art in Jamaica. So Pretty much, if you're going to get any kind of sponsorship for a project, you're going to have to deal with that question. And you're going to have to deal with all sorts of corporate branding all over your event and all over your... So, in many times, I think it's something that, as Heidi says, can be turned into something positive. It just has to do with the limitations that they are going to set on the sponsorship, whether it's going, whether it will be worth taking. You know, if we get sponsorship from a bank and they tell us that we cannot show a certain type of artwork because of it, then of course it's not a viable sponsorship, and of course we're not going to take it. So, you know, you have to just assess it. I don't think that it's bad money because it's associated with a particular organization. For me, it becomes bad when it limits what you can do as an artist and what exactly the mandate of the organization is and whether it's forcing you to go against that mandate. Yeah.
Okay. Have you... You asked a question, but has there been times where you denied possible funding because of the connections or implications?
I think that I would not take money from Philip Morris, mm-hmm. period, because of its practices in the developing world right now are appalling. I did a film about following Philip Morris in Vietnam and other countries where they so aggressively get young people addicted since the United States has made a big decline. So I think for me, I think ethics are really at the core of what I'm trying to explore. How do we live as filmmakers? How do we live as artists and live in a real world and integrate with that world and try to kind of have our work and the funding of our work and where the work is exhibited kind of be in some kind of dialogue with who we are? So for me, that's a big question. It's come to my mind because the Ford Foundation, and I don't even know if it's still true, started to have a policy that you had to sign something that's very heavy, which was you were signing that basically, I forgot the language, and it was basically that you would not do anything to harm the United States. I'm saying it in the most blatant way, but this is the Ford Foundation, the biggest funder of arts, the biggest funder of film. So that was a real conflict that I can't do work that's questioning the practice of policing in the United States, which comes out of such a very intense history in terms police didn't just become bad in the last 20 years or the institution. So basically that a film that's critiquing or an art piece that's critiquing something that's problematic about this country, that I would have to sign something, that's a real conflict for me. And, you know, I think we all engage with that navigation. And what do? You know, we're desperate to get money for the, you know, the keeping a place together that's so important and incredible in Kingston, Jamaica. But then how do we navigate that? And I think that's something we're going to all keep on exploring until we can get decent public money.
Right. I wanted to shift a little bit to kind of audience, right, and kind of artists, both maybe audience participation with some of the social practice projects you guys have done, or maybe in the broader question of like, how does the audience fit into these projects? And like, I mean, it's related to the community question we talked about before, but maybe especially with like new media and interactive work. Shasha, if you wanted to.
Well, the audience, it would change based on the venue. So if it was something that's web-based work, my audience, I see it when I design and work together with people. We're thinking about the public, anybody that has access to the web. So that's a wider audience. When you design, you have to think about everybody from age, gender. How can we design this so that it's legible? When it's something in public space, like this project downstairs in the garage, we have to think about how are people going to come into this space? How can we adjust and work with what we have? And then how can they experience this with other projects there? So I think, you know, the audience answer changes and shifts based on the medium that we're presenting in and the space. So as installation artists, you know, we always have to think about what is this space? What do we work with? What are the challenges? How can we still get the idea through? So it's constantly changing and adjusting.
And Heidi, for your work, where I know you mentioned the sort of the, in many ways the community is a subject,
right.
But then so once the work is made, maybe you speak a little bit about kind of just so we can visualize what kind of work you do.
Okay.
But then does it go back to the same community as its audience, or is it intended for kind of a broader interpretation?
I would like it to be for a broader audience. Mm-hmm. I want to introduce people to the stories that are told through history. I do a lot of research, and then I go and I do collective interviews that would highlight people's stories. So I'm always invested in the individual, in the individual as a broader voice. I just do the archive and the research that's necessary to tell people's individual stories, but collective, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. For instance, I did a portrait that was at the Smithsonian through the Alwin Bochover portrait competition, and it was called for Delia. And Delia was a slave, and her portrait I was introduced to many years ago in the 90s at the Harvard Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology. And her portrait, particularly her gaze, was the most important component to the work. I wanted to introduce a lot of young people, older people, anyone who would listen, the voice of Delia, her story. So I photographed myself, mm-hmm. and it became something that I think, as I was inspired by her story, I saw something in her gaze that was just amazing. I saw more than just a subjected body. I saw a woman who had a little bit of defiance, and I saw humanity in her gaze. So those are the things that I try to do when I do my social portrait practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Deborah, for you, I know your project is fairly new in Jamaica, and I know you said earlier that part of it is building a community. But I'm curious. I'm sure people would be curious too. Kind of how, what has the reception been like from the audience, the general audience in Kingston, to this new, obviously new forms of art making, collaboration. It's also connected to a recording studio too. So I'm sure interested to kind of hear kind of what some of the projects are and kind of what has been the feedback, right?
Okay. Well, it's been a process. Mm-hmm. You know, the reception was hot cold. I moved back to Jamaica 2.5 years ago and promptly started the project. And, you know, it was very alien in that why would an artist start a space? And why would an artist start a space for work that looks completely foreign? I mean, you know, we have Leisho Johnson's work. There were no commercial galleries that showed Leisho's work. All the commercial galleries have pretty much transitioned into this sort of frame shop model in Jamaica that resembles a lot like the mall galleries that you'll see here in these suburb malls. It's a very interesting transition. So when I came and started this space, it was very much people would show up. A lot of people would show up to say just basically, what on earth is this? And in that respect, it was good because then, you know, you when there's nothing else like it, then you actually have an opportunity to really build what people expect because they don't have any real expectations, even though they may say that they do. There really is not a model yet. And so you are presented with the opportunity to build a new model. And it was, the reception was, a lot of people came, but it wasn't that they came because they loved what we were doing. They just thought it was crazy. And some of the projects that we started off doing was our artist residency project. And Wilmer Wilson was our very first artist in residence, who was a Washington, D.C. based artist. He's now at UPenn. And the whole structure of it was to send out a call to artists. They would they had an application process, and then we funded their project through Kickstarter. And that is just the model that we use. So if you're an artist, one of the first things that you have to do is help us build a video for you and a Kickstarter campaign, and then we promote it for you. And through that process, you are actually, we as an organization and you as an artist are actually extending the visual vocabulary of the public, right? Because you are in the process of fundraising rather than having a private or a public, a private or a governmental funding where it's really closed. You're doing it all very public. You're doing it all very out in the open. And at that time, you are increasing the public's visual vocabulary. And for us, that really feeds back into the project, because as the project unfolds and builds, people are really attached to it. And that's where it really starts to become more of a warm reception, because it's no longer, what the hell is this? They feel invested in it, and they feel involved in it, and they feel like they understand it, and they do understand it at a deeper level because they saw it being built. And they have an understanding of the artist and what that artist is about. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, a little bit. Like in Wilmer Wilson's case, being from the U.S., so he went to Jamaica and did new work there, right? Mm-hmm. Can you kind of tell us what was his experience like?
I'm sure his experience was really tough. Jamaica is Kingston is just a tough space to be in. As I said, you're dealing with economic issues. We're dealing with the fact that, you know, there's a reason why artists go to New York. There's a reason why artists go to specific cities, because it's easier to be the hundredth artist doing something a particular way than it is to be the first person doing it. A lot of venture capitalists say it's easier to make the 100th deal than it is to make the first deal, right? It is harder when you're not in a hub of activity. So I'm sure it was tough for him. It's tough for us and every new artist that we have. And we've only had four artists in residence. And So I'm sure it was, and navigating the space, but you know, you just have to be a soldier about it. Mm-hmm. And he did it, and the project was really well received there. And in increasing that visual vocabulary, you're also starting a cross-cultural dialogue as well. And one of the reasons why Wilmer was one of the first artists, that call that we give out twice a year is open to local artists and international artists. But our local artists were just like, what the hell is this, right? Like, what is an artist in residence program? And why, as an artist, would you ever do this for me as an artist? Mm-hmm. So, I was interviewed on, you know, our national TV shows, morning shows, and one of the questions that kept coming up was, why would you do this as an artist for another artist? You know, so there is a politics of scarcity that's always at play, that people just won't understand why, if you're struggling for the same resources that I'm struggling for, why would you ever do that? Mm-hmm. So you're building a new model, and I always think that's a great opportunity to be in, to be able to build a new model of doing things. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
No, great. I mean, I think part of what you touched upon is this idea of activism, right? And actually, I mean, we're all artists, but there's also, and it's not required, but there's a set group of artists that start organizing things. You know, they just have it kind of in their DNA, and some artists don't have it. You know, but it's like, just it's self-imposed, right? It's more difficult to do that when you already have to do your own work. You know, so what? Maybe you guys could talk about that too, like how just this impetus to create, you know, to help people, to educate, right?
Well, for us, because we work in a college, our students also challenge us with their ideas. And part of the graduate program is to create socially conscious work for the public. And the challenge, you know, with some of these very difficult topics that students might have How do you make it easy for people to understand in the short attention span that we all have these days? For the web, it's 2 seconds. I tell everybody 2 seconds. If you don't have their attention in 2 seconds, you've lost them. For installation art, you know, once you have the person in the space, what do they walk away with? What can they walk away with? Have you sent the message? How can we build this to really make people think? The idea is to start a dialogue and to talk about it. And I think when we start talking about it, that's when we can educate each other with our different views.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us how you guys started collaborating, and even a little more about the surveillance project?
Okay. I love collaboration, but I don't build institutions. Like, what you're talking about is brilliant. I don't feel like I can do that because I'm working so hard in terms of being a professor and a teacher, educator. I try to do it in terms of fostering that knowledge, that collaboration is so valuable. But I'm very engaged with organizing. But my organizing, I was the head of the union at Hunter College for 11 years, and I recently got back from the West Bank, and without going off topic too much, I've been very engaged with Jewish Voice for Peace, which is doing a lot of work around what's been happening for the last, since 1967 in Palestine. So I'm very engaged in that, and I would probably find it too hard to then work among artists to bring something which is so valuable and absent, certainly in New York. There's minimal collectives. What we've done in terms of this particular project, which is called Surveillance, Silence Equals Death, is try to look at the broader community and engage with that community around the increase of surveillance and the difficulty for whistleblowers to really express themselves at this particular moment. And it's fun technology. Even the cards we have to talk about who we are, if you scan them with an iPhone or a smartphone, you get to the website and you find out about the project, and we'll put on it photographs from this exhibit here. And then we have cards that we've created which have information but not the name of people who've been either a whistleblower or who've been impacted by having been witness to something that was devastating in Iraq, or something like Snowden, or all different kinds of people's experiences very much post 9/11. And so you have little clues, but if you scan it, you'll find paragraphs about the people, but you could scan the same card and you get different information about the same people. So it's this kind of endless sense of learning. Now it's kind of navigating and dancing between an art project and to look at something in this creative way, and also that you're engaging and maybe learning, and then you could take the knowledge and share it with other people. And that's a dance, because I think we're dancing a little together, because, and sometimes not always, maybe we're also dancing on each other's toes, because it's a very, how do we have something where people get it?
And cards are a good metaphor for interacting, because if you give somebody a playing card, automatically there's so many things that we don't have to teach about a card. You know, it's random, you can shuffle. It acts as a great medium to develop, to deliver the message that we have. And then you don't have to figure out how to, you know, what is a card, right? We all know what a playing card is. And the other thing with scanning is we're forcing the user to do some kind of scanning or to do something. When you go shopping, this stuff has to be scanned. Surveillance, you're being scanned all the time, your data. So this is a way, I think, and for us in the collaborative work, this is a great medium for us to kind of deliver the message or to even start the debate or a talk about the whole topic.
Okay, great. How are we on time? Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.